Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, we'll explore how artificial intelligence is reshaping career paths in Central Ohio. Jay Fox will speak to experts about Columbus history, what makes a good dad, and summer reading. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
Unemployment in Columbus is at 3.6%. Well, that's relatively low compared to the rest of our state. Over 40,000 people are still looking for work. Artificial intelligence is changing how people work and, frankly, how companies do their hiring. Many employees and job seekers may not know how to use the technology and may not understand how it will affect their future. While AI can generate content and code instantly, experts say it is more likely to reshape jobs than eliminate them, which increases, not decreases, the need for workers to adapt and build new skills. There's a great new book called Open to Work. It offers insight into where opportunities are emerging and the skills that people need to succeed, and also how the technology can support career growth. So, joining us now on the program, Columbus Perspective, is the author, Anish Raman, who is also the Chief Economic Officer at LinkedIn, which I must say, I'm a user. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Jay.
It's our pleasure. All right. So, how is AI reshaping the workplace? Because I know how it helps me do my job.
Yeah, I mean, I think something you said there about it changing jobs more than ending jobs is the key. Work is changing. It is not ending. And I'm going to say that again because I know the headlines are fueling a lot of fear out there. Work is changing. It is not ending. It is going to change for all of us. You could be CEO at a company or the newest employee at a company. Your job is going to change, and it's going to change in big ways. Probably the biggest data point in this book to me is the number 70%. That's a percent of skills that are going to change in the average job by 2030. That's a lot. That means your job is changing on you, even if you aren't changing jobs, into kind of an entirely new job. Now, a lot of that is going to come down to these tools, and we walk you through it in the book. These are really easy to use tools. If you haven't used them yet, find something you don't like to do. It could be an exercise plan or a meal plan at home. It could be a project at work, summarizing things or doing the first draft of things that you absolutely hate. Use these tools for that, just to get familiar with them and to start to see what they can do. But then really, you're going to want to reshape your job over the next few years and see where you can give work to AI, what you can do new with these tools, learn something new, create something new, and then that should open up time for you to do stuff that's unique to us as humans. AI can do a lot, but so can we, so can humans. And one thing AI cannot do is beat us at doing what we do best, which is imagine, invent, create. And we talk about all this in the book in terms of how to build those skills.
Why do you think people are so afraid of AI? Because there is a movement to emotionalize AI and have them do exactly what you just described in the future.
Yeah, it's a new technology with capability unlike anything we've seen before. And so first, as we talk about in the book, just what is the biology of being human? Our brain is wired to fear change, and it is not wired to get big change, exponential change. So this is profound change. I think this is going to be the greatest disruption to work in human history. So it makes total sense that we're all stressed out, afraid, unsure, anxious. We also are skeptical often, and I think understandably so, that any sector, let alone the tech sector, is going to come save the day and that this is all going to be great for everyone. So the apprehension is real, and I get it. But I think a lot of the headlines have been about predictions, and you really can't predict much right now about where work is going in this sector or in this region, what's going to be the job of the future. You can't predict that right now. Instead, what we're pushing everyone to do is just act. I mean, where we go next is not determined, but it will come down to what we do now as individuals, as organizations, as societies, as humanity, the beliefs we hold, the choices we make, the steps we take. And so we've all got to start engaging in this moment. And then I think it will lead to better. It'll lead to better work. Remember, in the industrial age, from the steam engine to now, work for most humans has just been supporting the machine at the center of the production of goods and services. It's been about efficiency above all else. We're about to get out machined by a machine, and that's okay. We're humans. We're not machines. We've got a lot of other capabilities that now are going to come to the center of work as the mind comes to the center of work. And so you're going to want to work on those. We call them in the book the five C's: curiosity, compassion, creativity, courage, communication. We talk about habits like resilience, adaptability. All of it is sort of becoming more entrepreneurial at work. You've got these tools to help you get rid of the drudgery and efficiency work, to create new things, learn new things, and to create space and time to do new things with other people. So that's a mindset I think we all got to approach this moment with.
All right, we have three distinct groups to consider. One is those who are not working but are about to enter the workforce for the first time. The second group would be those who are currently working. And the third group would be those who are either about to retire or have recently retired but have decided to re-enter the workplace. Which of those three groups has the most advantage when it comes to using AI?
It's such a great question, and I'm not saying this as a cop-out, but it really comes down to each individual. And are you, with belief and with action, taking advantage of the change that's hitting? You could be any one of those three groups, and you could end up in 5 years with more opportunity than you could ever have imagined for your career. You could be any one of those three groups and be resistant to change, not know really how to adapt, not want to adapt, and you're going to be in a tough spot in 5 years. We talk a lot, generally, about those folks coming in the labor market, because it is a tough labor market. But those folks are starting with some strengths. They know these tools. These tools have been around the whole time they've been in college, and they are kind of more entrepreneurial at their core because they know about the gig economy, the creator economy. They don't trust they're going to go to one job at one company and then retire there. Those are skills employers want, an entrepreneurial mindset, ability to know AI. But if you go to those later years, people that are looking towards retirement first, reset your plan. I mean, work's going to change. You can't count on anything being true over the next 5 to 10 years. So make sure you're using these tools and understanding how they're going to change your job. But if you've been in the workforce for a while, you're pretty good at those social skills. You're pretty good at those capabilities that a lot of the younger folks are going to take time to learn. So your role as sort of a mentor, as a guide, as a coach, as a team leader, that's going to be more important than ever before. That's where work is going. So are you indexing your job on that? And then the folks that are sort of mid-career, we're not talking enough, I think, about them. People kind of in my age group, in their 40s, you got to get ready to restart. And if you've had a career where you kind of checked every box, you did everything right, and it feels like you're now at a stable place where you can just kind of be, I'm sorry to tell you, like, you did everything right. You played the game as it was. The game is completely changing. And so you've got to start resetting and almost re-enter the workforce. And it's going to be hard. You're going to fail at things. You're going to learn things. But you got to get into a cycle of trying the tools and starting to see how you're going to change your job on your terms.
So let me ask you this question. Let's say that I've been comfortable in my job for 10 or 15 years. I have a resume that's solid. Can I use AI to analyze my skills and abilities and then perhaps match me with a new opportunity and potential new employers? Is that a possibility?
100%. This is the easiest to use technology that humans have ever created. Like, don't let it get too complex in your mind. It is literally like talking to another person. You go to the tool, you could even take to that tool the question you just asked me and ask it to evaluate what you need to shift, what you need to learn, what your competitive edge is, where is your competitive edge most competitive in terms of company type or sector type. If you're in a job, we make it really easy in the book. Put aside your job title. No matter, again, if you're CEO or the newest hire, every week we do a dozen tasks in our job. And AI isn't coming for job titles, it's coming for those tasks. So list the 12 things you do on a given week that matter most. And then you're gonna bucket those 12 things. The first bucket, stuff AI can do. So this means you gotta be AI literate. You gotta know what AI can do. It can do quick summary. It can do quick research and analysis. It can code. It can do more and more. So you gotta figure out what can it do, and that's in bucket one. Bucket two is, what do you do with AI? So what you just raised, that's a bucket two task. Have it evaluate you. Ask it a bunch of questions to refine how you're thinking about yourself and the jobs you can go for. You're not assigning AI to tell you the answer. You're telling it to give you information and to ask you questions and push you in ways that gives you the answer in your own head. You can use it to create a video, to create a PowerPoint, to visualize something you want to present at the meeting you got to do next week. That's all bucket two. And then bucket three is stuff you're doing that's just because you're human, that's you. That's having more time to think critically. If you're a computer scientist, you might be coding less, but you might be talking to customers more. You might be thinking about the ethical implications of what you're building more. That's bucket three, partnering with other people, brainstorming with other people, learning with other people. That's all bucket three. If in your job, most of your tasks are in that first bucket, that is a big red flag. You're in a job that is getting disrupted right now by AI. So you've got to start thinking urgently about how you're going to shift. Now, most of us, I would say probably all of us, have something in bucket two and bucket three that we can start from, that we can build from. But that's a really easy way for you to map out how vulnerable you are. But what we've realized as we've been out there with this book, that vulnerability is only part of the story. It's really then your ability to adapt based on that map. How resilient are you? How able to take on something new, to be uncomfortable, to get into the gym, to get into a cycle every day of pushing yourself in new ways? That's going to be the key to it all.
Some people say there are only two things guaranteed in life, death and taxes. I say the only thing guaranteed in life is change. And the book Open to Work solidifies that thought process and walks you through it, and so does the app LinkedIn. So we want to thank Anish Raman for being with us today. We could have talked to you for hours, but unfortunately we're out of time. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
As the country continues to look ahead to the 250th anniversary, its history is often told through major events and well-known figures. But what about the unsung heroes, the everyday people who shaped our country? As part of its year-long The Stories of Us campaign, Ancestry is spotting and spotlighting these often overlooked individuals and empowering people to discover their own personal ties to the history of the United States. Ancestry senior story producer and professional genealogist Nika Smith joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well. What inspired Ancestry's The Stories of Us campaign?
This campaign is really special to us because it supports a national storytelling initiative that we're, forging this year to honor everyday people whose contributions helped shape the United States over the past 250 years. So throughout this year, Ancestry is featuring more than 250 stories of individual lives, families, and communities that make up the fabric of America. Things like where they lived, the work they did, the families they raised, really all the ways, big and small, they made their mark.
Now, I'm sitting in Columbus, Ohio right now, a proud Buckeye here in the state of Ohio. Do you have any examples of unsung heroes that you've uncovered from our area?
Yes. For me, one of my favorites is Geraldine Jerry Mock, who in 1964 became the first woman to fly around the world solo. And she landed her plane, the Spirit of Columbus, at the John Glenn Columbus International Airport. She was 39 years old and had at least two children when she did this.
That's incredible. Now, what year was that?
1964. So this is recent history, at least
it sure is. Absolutely. Any other stories about the state of Ohio that come to mind?
Yeah, you know, the thing is, Ohio also has some connections back to the Revolutionary War. In fact, one of the things that I found when researching, just trying to find some stories to talk about today, was about how there's an area that folks who were living in Canada actually were kind of given asylum because they supported the effort. They were given that in the Columbus area. I did not know that. So it was like a whole little community that sprung up there. And I had no clue that this was something that had ties to Columbus and to the 250.
And also, Columbus, at the very same time that you're talking about, was a major stop along the Underground Railroad.
Correct. Correct. Yes. In later history, it was completely that. And I think these three stories that we're talking about now with Jerry Mock, with the Canadians seeking refuge, you know, an asylum in the United States of Columbus, and even down to the Underground Railroad, it really, really ties together just the unique, diverse history that the U.S. has and all the reasons why we should celebrate all of those stories.
Why do you think it's so important to preserve our history and no details about our past?
I feel like folks get an opportunity to really connect with just the fabric of who we are. It's one thing to know the more notable stories, like, you know, about the founding fathers and individuals that, you know, continue to make history now, but it's different when you find out your unique tie to those people and to those stories. And also, you know, when anniversaries and things like this take place, you can really call out the names of the folks that connect to your specific family tree, like you know who was alive and what they were doing when those incredible things were happening.
So as you guys planned for the 250th anniversary, what else did you do as a result of this campaign?
So this campaign has been super fun for me. We actually kicked it off at the beginning of the year in New York. We celebrated the Fire Department of New York's first black officer, Wesley Williams, by reuniting his descendants with those of the family he saved from a fire in 1929. And we even had a mural created to commemorate that historic rescue not far from the site where the fire happened. And then in March, we celebrated Women's History Month, and we hosted a bus tour in Chicago that celebrated influential women who built the city. And so I was there along with Chicago historian Sherman Dillo Thompson, and the tour highlighted trailblazers like Ada Sophia McKinley, who was the founder of McKinley Community Services, which is an organization that has supported thousands of Chicagoland families with housing, education, and social services for nearly a century. And then most recently, to honor Small Business Month, we organized a self-guided walking tour of the original farmers market in Los Angeles over Memorial Day weekend. And we did it in partnership with the 2026 James Beard Lifetime Achievement Award winner, Nancy Silverton. So this particular activation highlighted generational family business owners and the critical role they play in the city's history.
Given the response to all of these events that you have participated in, coordinated, and attended, is it going to continue, or are you going to continue doing these events throughout the year and beyond, perhaps?
Yeah, that's the hope and the plan. These events have been an incredible opportunity for us to connect with customers as well as people who might be curious about ancestry, and really just to help show the world the power of family history and what it can do when it's out in the community. So, yes, that is our hope and our plan. And we really hope that folks will join our effort and to share their family stories. And they can visit ancestry.com/stories of us and navigate to the 250 Stories tab and then click Submit Your Story, which allows you to upload photos and a submission where you just have to enter your name, email, a story title, and a little bit of a narrative.
And not every story has to be something famous. It could be something as simple as, I still rely on my great-grandmother's Russian chicken noodle soup recipe to get me through a cold.
That's exactly the type of stuff that we like.
All right. We want to thank Nika Smith from Ancestry for joining us as we celebrate the 250th birthday of these United States of America. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
The U.S. Census estimates there are 120,000 men here in Columbus who are fathers. I'm one of them. But my daughters are grown now. Being a good dad means different things to different people. Some dads enforce the rules. Some dads entertain the family. Some dads are household assistants, and other dads just do everything. Christopher Parent is the author of a book called Fragments of a Decent Man. It's a collection of essays about the trials and tribulations of trying to be a good man. He joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Christopher, what is your definition of a good dad, and how did you develop that concept in your brain?
Yeah, I think a good dad means lots of different things for different people, but for me at least, and I think for a lot of people, it means being humble. It means being kind, and it just also means being honest. It means being, you know, the best version of yourself, which means that it's okay to fail. And I think kids these days, live in this world of social media where comparisons are happening all the time. And I think there's a lot of FOMO. And I think, you know, as a dad, it just means saying, okay, you know, it's okay to fail, but, you know, how you pick yourself up and how you react is critical. And I think kids will feed off of that as we go.
Do you think there's a difference between being the father of girls or the father of boys?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have two daughters. It's amazing. And I grew up in a household of mainly men. I had a traditional family, a mother and father, and I had a brother. And I respected both my parents for different values they brought. And I just think parents need to be true to themselves and honest and embrace who they are. And I think kids will pick up on that. So, I do think there are different issues for different folks. For daughters, I felt like there was, especially with social media, there was a lot more pressure much earlier on than I thought. Lots of comparisons, and again, this fear of missing out or fear of failure and rejection. And I think that with daughters too, I think with girls, there's just such a high standard of who they are. They have to be, fit into this certain box. And I think that, we just have to let them grow on their own and fail, but again, pick themselves up and be resilient. I think for boys these days, it's tough. And I think there's a great book, Scott Galloway talks about Notes on Being a Man, and I highly recommend it. I think a lot of the themes that I touch on in this book are applicable. But again, I think it just goes back to some of the values that I think we've lost along the way of being humble and kind and respect for others and being vulnerable. But being strong in the sense of picking ourselves up and forging ahead and not really making too many excuses for things. The world is pretty tough, but just forge ahead and be the best version of ourselves.
Why do you think it's so difficult for some men to express their emotions? And how does that affect marriage and parenting?
I think we're taught to, again, just not show failure and to kind of grind in and just, to be very resistant. And I think it's critical for men, again, to be honest with themselves and to accept who they are and accept that they're not perfect. Our imperfections are our best asset. I played a lot of sports growing up and in college, and I think the best thing you could do as a sports team, as a coach, is to understand your weaknesses, right? I mean, it's to say, okay, this is how I can improve upon that. I think we're just taught in society that, again, that men can't fail. This vulnerability, I think, is key to having a healthier life. When I look at my dad, you know, he was a great man. He was a Vietnam veteran. He grew up very poor, but raised himself up from the bootstraps, was very successful on Wall Street. But he was a man that didn't really let his guard down. He was a great parent, great husband. But I think you know, and it's one of my essays that I write about. He died at 60, and I think he didn't live the healthiest life he could. And I think it's something where he was just so resistant to change and his lifestyle and who he was. And I think men can, you know, again, this is such a blanket statement, and I'm not a psychologist, but I think men and some of these stories talk about men that I've met through my life who've had a real impact on me and others. And I think, again, it's just, you know, embracing those values that made us who we are. And I think that we've kind of lost away a little bit in our society. As far as being a good parent, again, I'm not a parent counselor. You know, I've got a strong marriage, but everybody's marriage is different. I think it just means admitting mistakes and being honest with yourself. As you can tell, that's a theme in the book. I think really helps and supports that marriage and who we are in relationships.
The book is called Fragments of a Decent Man. The author is Christopher Parent. We thank him for being with us this morning. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Jay Fox.
If you know me, you know I'm an avid reader, and I'm a familiar face at the library. It's not uncommon for me to have two or three books going at a time. Here in Columbus, I'm only one of 1.3 million registered library card holders. There are a lot of us who love to read. Recently, Thrift Books conducted a summer reading survey examining how adults experience time, stress, and relaxation during the summer months. The findings reveal that while Americans miss the slower summers of the past, like I do, many have found an unexpected solution in reading. Joining us now on Columbus Perspective is Barbara Hagen. She's the Vice President of Marketing at Thrift Books, and we welcome her to the show. Good morning.
Good morning, Jay. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. What do you think is the driving force behind the feeling that summer moves too fast right now? That's what 3/4 of Americans said that.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're hearing from people. Summer just feels to be moving really fast. And I think one of the things is that it's just more structured these days than it used to be in years past. Our summers are filled with kids' activities and family to-do lists, and we just don't have time to really kind of exhale and relax like we used to. And then add on top of that, screens, they don't make it any easier. We also heard that the majority of people feel like screens take away from that feeling of summer. And so as a result, summer just feels really compressed, and we just don't have the chance to kind of enjoy it like we used to.
How has productivity culture ruined summer downtime? You talked about screen time. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, with productivity culture, we always feel like we have to be doing something. And so we start treating, even when we have it's a beautiful day outside, we have a mental checklist going of things that we have to go do. And, you know, we're constantly feeling like we need to earn our free time. And it's so taken away from kind of just that ability to relax and be free.
You know, I learned by example. I was a child of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and my parents would spend summer days when they weren't working sitting out in the backyard on lawn chairs. They always had the Cleveland Indians games on the radio, but they were always reading. So how does reading help slow things down and reduce stress?
Yeah, reading is one of those last few activities that's really kind of single tasking focused, right? When you read a book, you're immersed in the experience. You open the book, you're reading it one page at a time, you let yourself get lost in the story, and you're not distracted. And so reading allows, it's just naturally a relaxing type of activity. It allows you to just focus and not be kind of in that endless doom scroll kind of situation or be distracted by your devices.
I'm reading Yesteryear right now, and I'm doing it a couple of chapters at a time just because the material is so deep. But I find that when I'm reading that particular book, I am not paying attention to anything else. So I'm assuming that's one of the summer's most hot reads. What are some of the others?
Yes, I'm so glad that you mentioned that one. That's actually next on my to-do list in terms of reading. I think some of the other ones, it really kind of depends on what people are looking forward to. But this summer, for me particularly, I think is really exciting because there's a lot of great book-to-screens that are coming out in the movie theaters. So I always like to read the book first. One of the classics that's coming to the screen this summer is The Odyssey. That's a Christopher Nolan movie that's coming out in mid-July. So now's the perfect time to pick it up. I mean, it's a really dense book, but
yeah, it's like, what is that, like 1,000 pages?
Something like that. It's quite large. You got to start now if you want to have it done by July.
I had to read that in high school.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's been a while since I've reread that one, so I'm looking forward to rereading that.
There's another popular book coming out.
Another one coming out called The Dog Stars, and that's also another movie that's coming to theaters in August. So I would recommend that one as well.
So when we think about slowing time down, when you read a book like Homer's The Iliad or Fyodor Dostoevsky's, Brothers Karamazov, these are giant pieces of American literature. It's one of those things where the story literally sucks you in, and all of a sudden you look up and the sun's going down. Is that what we're trying to achieve?
Yeah, I think that what we're trying to achieve is just like, the feeling that you've had some time to relax and that the summer feels like it lasts longer. I think when you immerse yourself in a book and you start reading and then you look up and the sun's going down, you feel like you've kind of accomplished something, right? You look at the story that you've just been reading, you've immersed yourself in this other world, you've allowed your brain some time to relax. And I think that it's a kind of a really good feeling when that happens. You haven't just been running around with not much to show for it.
At one point in my life, I found that I wasn't reading as much as I used to or I wanted to. So I had to schedule reading time. And because my day starts at 3 o'clock in the morning, Monday through Friday, we have library time at 6 o'clock at night going into those days. And all I have to do is say library time, and then the cats come right to the bed. How do you like that?
I love that. I think that's great. You just schedule into your day, and I wish I could have my cats respond to that the same way.
Well, I'll give you a hint. If you happen to have a treat nearby, the cat might enjoy library time. I, in particular, have a cat that likes to sit on the book while I'm reading. So now we have two books so that she can sit on one and I can read the other. And when she moves, I move to the other book.
That's great. It's like she's reading along with you.
Oh, yeah. We even got on Canva and made a meme out of her with glasses reading a book just because no one believed that she was so in touch with reading. Here's another question for you. Barbara, how does one get into a book club? That would be a way to get involved in reading. And my question is, are all book they all seem to be weekday evenings. Are there any that meet during the day or on the weekends?
Yeah, I think it's, there's lots of different book clubs out there. There's a lot of virtual book clubs, too. So you can join those, and hopefully that works with your schedule. For me personally, I just look at my friend group and my parent groups, and we usually have the same schedule, so it always helps to join a book club with people who have a similar schedule to you. But there's also, at Thrift Books, we have the 500 billion page challenge, and it's not really a book club, but it's just kind of a social movement to kind of say, we're going to get our pages in, we're going to read more often. And so it's a little bit more low stress and low pressure than the typical book club where you have to show up and make sure you've read everything on the schedule that someone else has given you. So sometimes you just need to maybe do it a little bit on your own schedule.
I love that you mentioned The Odyssey, and I can't wait to see it in the theaters. And I will tell you that I have a group of friends where we read the same book before the movie comes out. Then we go see the movie as a group, and then we go someplace afterwards to debrief and discuss. Do you do the same thing?
I love that. I do that, but on my own. I don't have a group of friends that I do that with, so maybe I'll join your group.
Yeah, you come to Columbus, Ohio. I guarantee you we'll have a good time with a lot of cerebral people.
Okay, I'm in Seattle, but maybe I'll make it out there sometime soon.
There you go. How can people learn more and access reading resources? What is and perhaps people, because of the nature of this, they may want to read that survey. So where can we go?
Yeah, you can visit thriftbooks.com. And if you just type in the search bar Summer Reads, it'll take you right to a list of top titles that we're focusing on for the summer. And there's also a link to the survey out there as well.
All right. I want to thank Barbara Hagen, Vice President of Marketing at ThriftBooks, for being our guest. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
We're focusing on one of the key races in the November general election. Much of the spotlight has fallen on the races for governor between Republican Vivek Ramaswamy and Democrat Dr. Amy Acton, and U.S. Senate between former Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown and Republican Senator John Husted. But all four statewide offices are also up for election, one of those being the race for Secretary of State. The race literally took center stage at the Secretary of State's annual conference. The candidates, Democratic State Representative Allison Russo and Republican State Treasurer Robert Sprague, addressed a crowd of about 600 election officials from all 88 counties. I had the honor of moderating the discussions with each candidate. We focused on election integrity, security and accuracy, protecting the voting process and voter access to cast a ballot. On stage, we also hit on some of the key issues of the day, including voter photo ID, ballot drop boxes, early voting, and more. Then each candidate sat down with me backstage for one-on-one interviews on those same topics. I asked them both the same basic questions. You'll hear in-depth from both of them today, starting with Democratic candidate, State Representative Allison Russo. Why do you want to be Secretary of State? Why are you running for this office?
Well, I believe that the Secretary of State should be the state's number one advocate for voters. I always tell people, really, this office should not be a partisan office. It doesn't matter who people vote for, what issues they support or don't support. The Secretary of State's job is to advocate to make sure that every vote is counted, that voters' voices are heard, and that the information that they see when they go into the voting booth is accurate and it is unbiased.
Do you feel that Ohio's elections are secure and accurate?
Yes, I do. I feel that we have very secure and accurate elections, and it's mostly due to the hard work of our elections officials in every single county, both Republicans and Democrats. We have a fantastic process that has many checks and balances to it, and we really should not be making that more difficult for eligible voters.
But would you make any changes to the system to potentially make it more secure?
Well, I think, number one, we have secure elections. I think, you know, one of the jobs of the Secretary of State should be to increase the transparency in the process. I think there are a lot of unknowns that the public doesn't know about what are the checks in the process so that people feel more confident. So I certainly think the Secretary of State has a huge role to play in that. You know, when I think about how do we modernize our election process, it's how do we make certain aspects more convenient for voters, bring us into the 21st century. There are lots of opportunities, I think, to do that through the Secretary of State's office.
We just heard from Democratic candidate, State Representative Allison Russo. Now it's time to hear from Republican candidate, State Treasurer Robert Sprague. I asked both candidates in one-on-one interviews the same basic questions about why they are running and their stances on key election issues. Here's my interview with Treasurer Sprague. Well, first of all, Treasurer Sprague, just why do you want to be Secretary of State?
I want to be Secretary of State in order to run secure elections. We've lost trust in each other as the people of the United States and in our institutions. And my mission and my goal is to run the most secure elections in the history of the state of Ohio. And I have a unique set of skills and experiences as a leader that will let me do that job for the people of the state of Ohio. And so I'm running to sustain our republic.
Do you believe that Ohio's elections are secure and accurate?
Yes, we do a very good job in Ohio. And I'm not running to burn down the Secretary of State's office or our local boards of elections. But in any system, there are improvements that you can make. And I want to move to a front-end citizenship check so that only American citizens are able to vote in our elections and register to vote. I want to make sure that we're using paper ballots in every county for every election so that we have an immutable audit trail and that the machines won't be rigged. And I want to go to universal photo ID to make sure that people are who they say they are and are able to vote those registration records, and they can prove that they are that sovereign American citizen.
What do you mean by universal photo ID? Is that one card that everybody would have, or would it still be driver's license, passport?
No, it's not one card. It's whatever the photo ID is that you have. But it means that no matter how you vote, whether it's in person or by mail, that you're sending in your photo ID. You're either showing your photo ID or sending in a copy of your photo ID. We shouldn't have two different ways to run our elections, one in person and one by mail.
Photo ID is a big part of your platform, as you mentioned. Right now there is a joint resolution that would require, or that would put on the ballot, excuse me, a proposed constitutional amendment to require photo ID for mm-hmm. voting in the mm-hmm. state of Ohio. You've said that you support that. Why is it necessary, though, to put it in the Constitution?
Because you put the most important things in the Constitution. And this is so important. It's the keystone of the security of the election system. If we don't know that people are who they say they are when they show up, how do we know that they were able to vote that record that was registered? So this is fundamental to us as a society. And people show photo ID for hotels, you know, this cigarettes to buy cigarettes or to buy beer or to rent a car or to fly on an airplane. You know, they should have the same requirement for security in our election system to determine the future of our country.
Should the amendment also include protections for four specific types of identification that can be used when going to vote?
Look, that's a cop-out to vote against the amendment. I mean, the General Assembly can take care of the photo ID. I'd be fine if they put in the valid forms of photo ID as it is right now and put that into the Constitution. The key thing here is that we're putting it into the Ohio Constitution, and the power of that is that only by a vote of the people, once it's adopted, can the people of the state of Ohio remove it from the Ohio Constitution.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM, The Fan 2.